Alan Green Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 4, delivered on September 1, 2016. The title of this lecture is Ethics and Agency.
Tonight, Ethics and Agency. Now, as far as the topics go, they seem to be not related. But they seem to be unrelated, but they actually are. Because the first topic, ethics, gets into a real morass of what do we mean by ethics and what is your ethical backing, your foundations of ethics. And it could be several different legitimate approaches. The second part of the lecture on agency gives us as business professionals an actual framework for making ethical decisions, at least sometimes. The problem here is that ethics, I am supposed to teach you ethics. I'm supposed to teach you ethics because the accreditation agencies like it, and of course the state of Illinois wants me to teach you ethics, which is actually kind of hilarious. Sort of like Satan telling you to be a good person. And the interesting thing is that ethics, as the state mandates it, is to teach you state law and federal law. You will do this. You will not do this. And if you do this, you will go to prison for this long or you will get this fine and all that. And here's some cases of people who didn't obey the law. That's not ethics. That's just the swaggering of state, telling people what to do and pretending it is ethics. Ethics is a lot more difficult than that. You can't... Well, let me start with a live example, a real life example of an ethical problem or an ethical challenge, if you will. I'm going to approach someone in this classroom. Ma'am, what is your major? Okay, not finance, right? Well, that's going to be tough because you're in the social sciences, which kind of gives you a different perspective than a businessman, a business person, excuse me. But so you don't have that killer shark, although you might, I don't know. That might be a little tough for you to... Okay, no. No. Okay. Imagine a situation like this. You have these nations, all of them in the developed world, all of them respectable nations, and they have come together. They want to create essentially some kind of a framework in which their currencies don't deviate very much from each other. That way, none of them gets an advantage in exports and imports over another country in the trading group. You see, if a country's currency has a very low value, it can be a net exporter just because its currency is very low. Currency that has a very high value will be a net importer. Like the United States, our currency is loved all over the world. Don't let anyone tell you it's not. That's why our currency has a very strong value against others. That makes us an importer, which kind of bleeds our economy of jobs. But anyway, these countries want to get together to create an exchange rate mechanism, okay, so that the currencies can float against each other, but not too much against each other. So in other words, you would have a band in which a currency could float against another currency.
Okay.
Now, this one currency is sort of like the dominant currency, and everyone tries to is pegging against that, floating against that very strong currency, very strong, very good currency. So the other ones kind of latch onto it and ride it across time. Okay. Now, you don't live in any of these countries. You're a hedge fund manager in the United States, which isn't a party to this agreement at all. Something strange begins to happen. Well, not strange. One of the countries, or actually a couple of the countries, are beginning to suffer recession. Unemployment's going up some. Times are a little difficult. Now, in a situation like that, a currency will tend to fall in value, naturally. The currency is weak. Okay? So this currency begins to fall towards the lower end of its trading band against the strong currency that dominates the ERM, the exchange rate mechanism. Okay? Well, you're this hedge fund manager, and you're looking at this situation. And you say to yourself, that currency would really like to fall further than that, but it can't because of this agreement. So you kind of keep an eye on this situation. And the situation gets worse, and then it gets really bad because that strong currency that sort of is the leader of the pack of the exchange rate mechanism, that strong currency becomes massively stronger because that country begins to engage in a huge, almost incomprehensibly large project. So it starts to borrow money. And when it borrows money, it causes its domestic interest rates to go up. Interest rates are the price of a country's money. So that currency begins to strengthen relative to all of the currencies, and it strengthens a great deal relative to this one weak country's currency. So you've got a country that first was already, its currency was weakening because of a recession relative to this strong currency. Then the situation gets much, much worse because that strong currency becomes absolutely superpowered because it has to jack up its interest rates to borrow enough money for this insanely large project that it's undertaking. So this weak currency starts to bounce through time against the lower wall. That weak country has to start doing things to try to salvage, to keep its currency in the band. It starts to have to buy its own currency with its foreign reserves of other currencies to try to create demand for it. When that doesn't work, it starts using gold, its own reserve of gold, to buy its own currency, to try to keep it, hold it in the band here. It's beginning to wreck itself from the inside out. By the end, this already weakened economy starts to jack up its interest rates to try to strengthen its currencies. That just makes its recession worse. But you have already set the trap. Because you know nothing it can do can stop the exchange rate mechanism from collapsing, and that currency, that weak currency, is going to drop like a rock. So your hedge fund, and these are your little minions in the hedge fund, okay? You have to have one. Some cougar bait, and then some geniuses, okay? You're setting a trap. You're going to borrow massive amounts of this weak currency from the bank, central bank of this weakened country, and you're going to use that currency to buy the stronger currency so that when the exchange rate mechanism collapses, you can pay back those loans to that weakened currency in incredibly cheap money. because you held the hard currency, and when the weak currency collapsed, $100 million loan, I mean, you're going to only have to pay back really in true dollars, only about $60 million. But when you do this, well, you do it, and then the people in your hedge fund follow you in. And then these other hedge fund traders who know what you're doing, they jump in to get to set their traps. And all of you are just sitting there. And then when this country jacks up its interest rates, you'd be the ones who buy that currency because it's got such a strong interest rate, but you're not going to do it. You've already set your trap the other way. You're betting short. You're not going to help this country out of its problem. And then, sure enough, this country has wiped out its foreign reserves buying its own currency. Can't strengthen it that way. It's creaming its gold reserves. Can't buy any more of its currency. And it just says, that's it. We're out of the exchange rate mechanism. We're done. They tried to do the honorable thing to hold into the exchange rate mechanism because it was an agreement among these good nations. And finally, at the end of the day, after they had nearly, they basically magnified a recession into something close to a depression, trying to do what was right. They finally gave up, and the currency collapsed, and you guys came out unbelievably rich. You personally, as the head of the Quantum Fund, made $1 billion in 1992 dollars. That would be about $1.6 billion now. Your minions here, they pulled in another $400 million, which would be about $700 million in current dollars. These other traders, all who are following your lead, they took another billion. And all of that money came out of this economy that it was already shattered. And you sent a couple million people into unemployment. Families lost their homes. The suicide rate skyrocketed. Children lost their moms or their dads because their moms and dads knew that if they died, then the kids would at least be taken care of by the state. People went without food. People went without medicine. People went without jobs. But you made a fortune. You will never want for anything again in your whole life. Everyone will crawl to you. And the bad and those nasty conspiracy theorists who talk about what you did, well, you can just wave your hand and they go away. They really do. And then everyone is going to consider you the second Jesus because you are the greatest philanthropist on earth. You give to these poor people. You give to these charitable organizations. You move mountains, and even political candidates grovel in front of you. Professors talk wonderful stories about the genius of you, except for this one ass who tells the real story in his class, which is why he never gets invited to the parties. You're on the verge of pulling this trigger, going for the jugular, as the term was used at the time. You're already wealthy, but $1 billion in one freaking trade? That's butch, and you can do it. You'll never want for anything. You can be loved by everyone, or you can be alone. No one will ever criticize you that anyone will hear about. You will give money to organizations. Political candidates will listen to you. And you will live much longer than most people do. And all you have to do is pull that trigger. What are you going to do? Are you going to pull it? Don't say I don't know. Because you will do one or the other. You will? Okay. No, it's okay. No, don't be apologetic. Remember Arnold Schwarzenegger? He once made this really sexist comment. He said, "Don't be a girly man." He wanted people to vote Republican, so he said that. So, you know, think of it there. Don't be a sociology major. What will you do? Pull the trigger or not? You could have blown it all away. You know what you could have done? You could have saved that economy. You could have saved that economy by, when they jacked up the interest rates, you could have bought in on the currency and blown the short. Or you could pull the trigger. Which would you do? Don't ask us a question, for crying out loud. Don't worry. It's okay. Okay. Madam? You wouldn't. You'll be hated. You'll be hated by all of these people who set their positions again with you. And they'll say, "What are you doing here? What, did you just become a socialist or something?" But you wouldn't. Talk to me. You wouldn't? How about you? Well, who is it I'm talking about here, by the way? No, oh no, 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 no. Long before that. Who is the man I am talking about? Soros, yes. George Soros. The trade of the century. The great philanthropist. The leader of the pack. The head of the quantum fund. You won't find a website that trashes what he did. I had a link to one. Yeah, I actually kind of knew the guy. He just told it, the whole story, straight up, and he said, here's what this caused. And here's what your hero did to the Bank of England. That's the only one. Oh, you can find conspiracy websites. And that's one of those interesting things. The crazies are allowed to keep their websites going because they're crazies, and that makes everyone think that this is a crazy thing that's being said. So who's going to listen to an Alex Jones or someone like that? You know, they are nuts. I mean, they are bat shit crazy. I mean, that's a technical term. But sometimes they do tell what actually happens. But it's great to have conspiracy theorists be the ones who talk negatively of you, because everyone knows they're crazy, so that must mean you're okay. Soros will let those kinds of, Soros and his little minions will let that kind of stuff go on. But the serious attacks on him, well, you'll notice I don't have my website anymore. That was just one of the things that I talked about. Look, ethics, real ethics, not this phony stuff that they want me to teach you. Real ethics is hard because you can take a couple of different approaches. You can put them into two big categories. One of them is this: you will do this in all situations. Whenever that's any situation arises, you've got a rule that you don't violate. A philosopher named Immanuel Kant laid it out in what was called the categorical imperative. And you don't have to write that down. But he simply said, you will always do what you would want someone else to do to you. Like the golden rule. Okay, that is a categorical thing. You're not going to ever say, well, this situation is a little different from this. You're always going to do the right thing. Now, on the other side are pragmatic approaches. And there are several different schools. John Stuart Mill had one, then there are a couple of others. But basically the approach is this, that you can't set a rule that is forever and for all time. You have to look at the situation. Now you can set sort of like a meta rule. Now a guy like John Stuart Mill had sort of like a meta rule. In other words, it was sort of like a framework. Always do what is best for the most people. That's one way you could take it. Well, then the situation would govern what is best for the most people. That's one approach. And then there are other approaches, too, that are situational. you do what is right by the least of the people. That would be sort of like a rabbinical approach of this kind of crazy rabbi named Yeshua about 2,000 years ago. And philosophers after him, political and social philosophers after that and before that, took this approach that whatever you're going to do, how is this going to hurt the people who are the weakest? Now, that is not, doesn't sound like a pragmatic approach. You see, a pragmatic approach, why would I worry about that little kitten over there? Well, the problem is that if you keep punishing and hurting the small marginal groups, they could possibly someday get angry enough that they have nothing to lose, and then they're going to tear down everything that you've built. That's the danger with ignoring the little tiny things, the little tiny people, is that sometimes, pragmatically, you screw them over enough times, they're going to bite you in the ass. Okay? So the ethical dilemmas that we face in the business world can be really painful. For example, if you have the chance, and I assign these cases, these readings to my FIL 349 students. Interestingly, this whole slate of investigative articles that I was assigning for about 5 years, to, 4 years to my FIL, my advanced financial theory and problems students, they're gone. Rolling Stone magazine had been publishing the investigative reports of a financial, just a genius of financial analysis. And he had blown the cover on all of these dirty deeds these big banks were doing, these traders, currency traders, commodities traders, the government. He was blowing the cover on all of this. And suddenly, just this past summer, my students are saying, all your links are broken. What the heck, man? Yeah, they're all gone. All gone. But anyway, if you're a whistle, you find out that your bank is screwing its borrowers. I mean, it's serious. You're calculating billions of dollars that they have taken in phony fees and miscalculations, deliberate miscalculations from consumers. Usually the weakest consumers, these are the ones that don't have money. They have to borrow to get by. Or they have to borrow at high interest rates because they have bad credit, because their lives haven't been perfect. Okay? You see it happening. You report this to your superior who says, yes, we'll look into this. And you see it still going on. You've done within the system. Should you let it go? Are you going to let it go, or are you going to blow the whistle to the outside world? Which are you going to do? Let me give you a caution. Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I, the investigative reporter, described one woman who did the wild thing. She blew the whistle. Her life was destroyed. They sent lawyers after her. The government went after her because she was disclosing secrets. They crucified her. Her family was wrecked. Her marriage was ruined. She lived in hotels in fear of her life for years. So, are you going to blow the whistle?
Probably not.
Good girl. You know, they said, someone asked me this. Okay, fat boy, are you going to do it? And I said, hell no. No. Do I look stupid? See, I'm not one of those big, bulls that you see on Wall Street. I am this little rat. And you know why I'm a little rat? Because little rats can run undercover, and the big things can't hurt them. Okay, so, but would you blow the whistle? You? No? Okay. It's okay. Of course, the government will always make everything right, right? This is the problem, though. Ethics gets down to some really painful choices. Is it you or the other guy? And sometimes you have to say, it is, I'm going to save my own skin here. Okay. Now that I've made this really complicated for you and shown you the weaknesses of our own, no matter how hard we want to think of ourselves as good people, we're going to try to save our own skins as many times as we can. Now let me take you over to agency. And this provides at least a framework in which you can think about some ethical problems. It doesn't sound like I'm going to do that with this topic, but I do. By the end, you begin to see the framework. It's actually interesting because it's almost like a fusion of that pragmatic approach and that absolutist approach. Follow with me. I'm using the term agent. An agent is a person who is charged with maximizing some welfare of another person. Who is called the principal. Now, let me warn you about something. When I say the word person in law can mean an individual, or it could mean something larger that is recognizable, identifiable, and legally binding. So a partnership can be a person. A corporation is a person in law. A contract can create a person. A marriage is a person. Now, the problem with this is that this is, we have to use that word person for a corporation, for example. But it was taken in the wrong way by the United States Supreme Court more than a few years ago. They said, well, a corporation is a person, so it's got the same rights as any other person in the Constitution. They kind of took it beyond its normal usage and said, okay, corporations have free speech rights. Corporations have these rights that are supposed to, in the Constitution. I'm pretty sure the framers of the Constitution meant those rights were for citizens, but the Supreme Court said, oh no, it's a person, so the Constitution it protects the corporation as a person. Setting that aside, though, that rather legal, which is still galling to some, even some conservatives, I consider myself an old-fashioned conservative, not one of these flaming-haired conservatives now, but even as an old-fashioned conservative, I don't want person to be taken too literally with respect to these things that aren't human beings. But anyway, let me take it back here. So when I say person, it doesn't have to be an individual. It can be an individual, but it could be something larger than an individual. So an agent is a person, something that has some contractual obligation to maximize the welfare of another person. Now, when I say contractual, you all took FIL 185, is it? Okay, well, you didn't take it from me, so you might not have gotten everything right. I shouldn't say that. Eric Rude is pretty good at this stuff. But I do want to bring this up. A contract doesn't necessarily have to be in writing. I mean, an oral contract is actually an excellent. Most contracts, almost all contracts actually are oral. You can also have contracts that are implied in fact or implied in law. So a contract, when I say contract, it doesn't have to be a written agreement. But it is there. So anyway, there is some contract, written, oral, or implied in fact or implied in law, that charges this person, the agent, with maximizing a welfare, some welfare, of another person who is called the principal. So, for example, I own a company, you work for me. You're the agent, I'm the principal. Okay, now let's take it a little a step further. A, a parent and a child. Who is the agent and who is the principal? Yes, yes. No notes. You said it right the first time. The parent would be the agent because the agent is the one that is charged with maximizing the welfare of the other. So the child is the principal in a parent-child relationship. Okay. In a marriage, and this steps into some pretty troubling territory. Madam, in a marriage, who's the agent and who's the principal? Oh, well, yeah, right. Oh, no. Hey, you say, oh, hell, I'm the principal. No. Actually, neither. The marriage contract, the marriage is the principal. You, the husband and wife, are the agents. See, the marriage is not a human being, but it is an entity. It is a person under the law. And both of you are charged with maximizing the welfare of that entity. That is your duty. So, you are married now. Your wife is out of town. And you get a call from these former friends of yours at this fine university. It's a sorority and a fraternity get together, and they need a judge for a twerkathon. And they asking you, because you are the twerkathon master. She doesn't know. She's out of town. And when it's over, you know, you can take the face paint off and all the funny decorations they put all over you to win favor for the judging contest. And so you see, there you go. You're supposed to be doing everything to maximize the welfare of the principal, the marriage. Not her welfare, not hers. She's another agent. For all you know, she is out with some boy toy. Not that one, no. Okay, you follow the point, though, is that you're both charged with maximizing the welfare of something that doesn't even have a brain. Now, I'm going to take you on a completely different track and then bring it into this one. This young man wearing that Reggie, my main bird, is my main bird thing, whatever that is. Okay. Now, see, you're driving your car out on the great American prairie, out on one of these straight country roads. It's a sunny day. It's just beautiful. There's no traffic whatsoever. And you see a speed limit sign, 55 miles per hour. Now, I've noticed out here that 55 miles per hour is not a statement of law. It's a challenge to you people. And it's just straight, clear, no traffic anywhere. And you hear this little voice in the back of your head. It says, warp 6. And so you put your foot down on that pedal, and you see stars starting to turn into streamers on the sides of the car. And you hear someone in the back, "Captain, we can't hold the warp engines any longer. They're going to blow." Okay. You're driving like a blind trout. Visualize that, if you will. Way, way up the road. This is all farmland. One of those spurs into the field where there's some, like a little drive into one of the fields. You see a car. Huh. Someone's parked up there. You get closer, and you notice that there are lights on the top of that car. And there's yellow lettering, and I'll be darned, that looks like that says sheriff. What are you going to do? You're coming up on it faster. You're going warp speed, man. You're going to get to Proxima Centauri and that new planet they found there within a few days. Okay, what are you going to do?
I mean, if I can't break
them. Well, sure you can. You're going to break, aren't you?
Yep.
Well, yeah. You ever notice when you're driving down the road and all these people are driving like maniacs, they're flying past you, and all of a sudden all their brake lights come on up ahead?
Yeah.
That's usually a cop, and they've just found Jesus. Yeah. You're going to slow down. First rule of contract enforcement, monitoring. You must monitor. But then as you get closer and closer, you see the cop is out in front of the car or beside the car. Oh, gosh, he's got one of those radar guns. And he's going to nail me. He caught me way up there. And then you realize he's not standing. He's leaning over. Oh, my goodness, he's got a flat tire. He's not looking at me. He's looking at that flat tire. Ain't going to get to the donut shop, is he? No. You see, he can't chase you. What are you going to do? Oh, you better believe it. You waved. Oh, hi. Well, enforcement is the second foundation of a contract. Enforcement. Monitoring and enforcement. If either of those is missing, it's over. The contract is worthless. You can monitor, but if you can't enforce, you guys, did you ever have a teacher or someone who yelled at you all the time? I see what you're doing, but they didn't do anything. They were afraid to do anything to you. So you just kept doing it, you know. Found out that there wasn't any fear. Enforcement. You can talk about, well, I'm gonna teach you a lesson. Okay, fine, but you're not around. You don't see what I'm doing, so bite me. Okay? So both of those have to be in effect. Know this. The principal is responsible for the behavior of the agent. If you are the principal and the agent screws up, don't blame the agent, blame yourself. You were the one who had to monitor and enforce. Well, he should have done it himself. No, never assume your opponent's intentions, only his capabilities. This is a rule of warfare, and it's a rule of business. It's like President Reagan many years ago said in working on a nuclear treaty with the Soviet Union, trust but verify, trust but verify. No matter how much you think, well, this agent, he's maximizing my welfare. I believe in him. Oh, that's good. Maybe he or she will, but you have to assume that he or she will not. The agent, and this is the agency dilemma, the agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of the principal's. The agent has incentive. The agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of the principal's. That is the agency dilemma. Now notice the operative word there is has incentive. That does not mean that the agent will. But that's the whole point of monitoring and enforcement. If you can't monitor or you won't enforce, you got nothing. The agent can, you might have an agent who's great, but you also, the downside is that you might have an agent that's not. Agency in finance and accounting and in management in general, we consider agency in terms of liquidated costs. In other words, can we talk about agency cost? Okay, the four agency costs. The first one is pretty easy. Direct theft. Direct theft. Stealing. Pinching a couple of pencils to go home or something like that. Or something bigger, direct theft, okay? Are any of you accounting majors? The word is audit, of course. Well, we could trust everyone. Don't worry, don't give me those receipts. I know you're spending money wisely. Yeah, sure. Okay. You see, but here's, I'll tell you an interesting one. This sounds like, well, we're going to be suspicious of everyone. We're going to be a bunch of jerks and watch everyone and be jackboots. Let me tell you one of my early consulting stories. I was helping a company. It was a slaughterhouse in the state of New York. They needed to raise funds because they wanted to expand their facilities and also reach out beyond their regional market. And they wanted to start, because they had some pretty nice, interesting cuts of meat, and they did, it was a kosher house, and they had a very respectable brand. Well, I found out relatively quickly that they had a pretty serious problem with theft of food. They worked 2 to 3 shifts of people, had something like 40-some employees, and they, during the meat cutting, there were jokes about, a guy would come in looking trim and fit, and he'd leave, and he looked like he was 5 months pregnant. Well, that was his chuck roast that he was slipping out with. You know, they all kinds of schemes for wrapping stakes around the arms and stuff like that. They were losing quite a bit of money every month. They knew they were bleeding on cost. And so one of the things they were going to use this money that we were going to raise for them to do was to get all these security cameras and all of this kind of stuff. Well, we got bids on security cameras and security systems, and so we're going to use about $60,000 of this money. This was some years back, to get this whole system going up. We got them in the hallways and on the cutting floor and then out in the parking lot, 2 of them. That's just the beginning of it. You got to have people who watch those. What are you going to do? Just have them up there and think, oh, I got a camera. I'm not going to steal. They'll figure out quickly enough that there's monitoring but no enforcement. So are you going to enforce? Okay, there you go. How much is it going to cost you to have someone watching those cameras all the time? All of those scans, all those cameras in all those different places. And then what do you do if someone is caught stealing? You want to have one of your thugs go out there and shake the person down? Well, there's a liability lawsuit right off the top of my head. Plus, you're going to get cracked down on by the National Labor Relations Board for your brutal treatment of your employees and all this kind of stuff. You're going to be in a world of trouble. You're going to pay a lot in insurance costs for the liability alone. It was interesting, though, that this younger fellow, he was a son of one of the owners, and he would eventually be an owner, too, a junior executive he was. He had a brilliant idea. He said, okay, why, instead of taking this, he used the term Nazi approach. He said, why don't we have Free Meat Friday? Every Friday, you can take home 5 pounds of whatever you want. Steak, roast, ribs, you name it, whatever you want. And you go out, we'll actually encourage you to do this. Every Friday, every person on the cutting floor, on each of the shifts. For one thing, that's going to make people not want to call in sick on Fridays. For another thing, we're not going to be trying to watch them to see what they're stealing. We know exactly what the cost is. It becomes just part of their benefits package, essentially an unpaid wage, non-taxed. Pretty cool idea. It was hugely successful. Theft went to zero. They had accounting. This meat they were giving out was not nearly as much as they had been losing in theft over the months that this had been going, over the years this had been going on. It was a brilliant idea. So don't get the idea that dealing with agency costs always has to be something where you're a jackass to your subordinates. Sometimes being creative saves you from monitoring and enforcement costs that could be worse than the original problem itself. Now let me go to the second one. Shirking, of deliberately avoiding your duties to the principal. The agent deliberately avoiding duties owed to the principal. It could be you hanging around the water cooler instead of doing your work at your desk. It could be you, sir, sharing the latest gossip with everyone in the office. It could be you playing Call of Duty. It could be you handling that boss in World of Warcraft. because you're level 90 and you've got to get above that or you're so lame. Okay? Shirking, deliberately avoiding duties. Shirking takes all kinds of forms. It's not only just low-level employees. A couple of famous stories. One, there was this manager in this place where I consulted. He bragged that every night his desk was clean. I make sure that I've taken care of all of my work. I never go home worrying about any problem that I haven't resolved. Well, you know how he did it? He would just literally, physically take his workload, and after all of his subordinates had left, he'd just put it on their desks. So when they came in the next morning, there was all this work that they hadn't seen when they left the night before. But this son of a dog, his desk was clear. That's shirking. There was another place I consulted. There was a mid-level executive. And I actually saw this. They told me it was going to happen, so I watched it happen. It was amazing. Every morning, he came in at 8 o'clock sharp, and he would walk by the receptionist's desk, grab the Wall Street Journal, and go into the men's room. And he would stay there for 40 minutes. That man was so damn regular. And after 40 minutes, he'd come out. He would have a spring in his step. He'd be feeling perky. He'd put that Wall Street Journal back on the receptionist's desk. I never touched that journal. That was nasty. And then he'd go to his desk and work for the rest of the day. Shirking. That's shirking. It was just like clockwork. I actually started timing him 40 minutes on the button. How do you do that? I don't know. Anyway. The next one is perquisites, sometimes called perks. This is agents taking benefits belonging to the principal by virtue of position. Agents taking benefits from the principal by virtue of position. This would be the executive who has the desk that is the size of a small aircraft carrier. The executive who has the nice cushy seat because his butt needs more padding than his employees who get these hard foam seats to sit in. This is the executives who get ridiculous, insane salaries. We know very well, we've researched this quite a bit, that above a certain amount of money, and it's surprisingly low, there's no more productivity. You don't get any more productivity out of a $13 million a year CEO than you get out of a $150,000 CEO. You don't. There's nothing. Perquisites. I had a dinner some years back, and I was with executives of this one really nice company, and one of them, a little tipsy, said, "You know, you should stop doing that teaching stuff. You're being paid terribly. We need a comptroller. We could use a guy like you." And I said, "You wouldn't want me. You guys fly these your executive jet to these locations for meetings. You stay in 5-star hotels and you eat like we are tonight in these ridiculously expensive restaurants. First of all, Greyhound goes to most cities, pretty much every city. You don't need your executive jet. We could sell that. As far as restaurants go, there's White Castles. And if your stomach's too tender for that, well, okay, we'll do Denny's. But you're not going to eat in fancy restaurants, and you're not going to stay in these 5-star hotels. That's not going to happen anymore. Motel 6 is everywhere. And if that's too expensive, I know some hotels that are cheaper." Hell, I lived in some. Actually came to give the cockroaches pet names. But anyway, you understand these are perquisites. They don't have to have them. Every dollar that those executives are spending goes out of the shareholders' pocket at the bottom line. That residual claim of the shareholders, those executives are taking it above the bottom line so it doesn't get down there to where the shareholders could have it. That is a perquisite. It's taking a benefit from the principals, the shareholders, because of your position. Now, the last one here, is, sounds like odd, incompetence. Have any of you ever worked with someone who is as stupid as a box of rocks? Yes. And it is literally an agency. He, you know, the one thing is, you know why you shouldn't beat a dog? Because it's a dog. Okay? I mean, the dog doesn't know any better. I mean, yeah, this dog knew he was going, oh, come on, get off that. Yeah? But this is like a stupid person. You can't really criticize a stupid person, you know. What are you going to say? You are stupid. You know, he probably already knows it. But this brings up an important management principle. This was published years ago by a professor and management expert named Dr. Peter. And it was sort of told in the popular media of the time like it was a joke. It's no joke. It's a true principle of management. Every employee rises to his or her level of incompetence. Every employee rises to his or her level of incompetence. Look. You're incredible in your job, your first job with it. And being great at what you do, you get a promotion. Well, you're great there too. Get another promotion because you're doing so well, you are promoted. But there's one place where the next promotion would be to the chief financial officer. You know very well you can't do that. Oh, you know very well you can't do that. But one day, you're sitting in your cubicle and everything's quiet, and then all of a sudden, over the Muzak, the speakers, you hear this funny music. Ba, 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 ba. Everyone's like, it's the CEO coming in! It's the CEO! And I'll be darned, it's Darth Vader, and he comes right up to you. I have heard good things about you. I want you to be the CFO. Together we can rule the galaxy. Join me or die. No, I can't do that job, sir. You're not going to do that. $1.3 million a year, your own car, and a key to the bathroom that Vader himself uses. How do you do that key? Well, you have to take anyway. But you're going to take it anyway. Even though you can't do it. You have risen to your level of incompetence and there you will stay. True with executives, true with sports coaches, true with politicians. Note the two running for president. I shouldn't say that. No politics in the classroom. Yes, it's true! No. The point, though, is that the Peter principle, it sounds like a joke. Everyone rises to his or her level of incompetence. No, it's actually a logical principle. So when you walk into your first job, you look around you. Everyone there is either on the road to or has achieved his or her level of incompetence. We are all on that road. Or we've made it. Hence why I'm here. Yep, I see the principle now. Okay, but you see, the incompetence can be flipped so that it becomes shirking. Because if you're smart, you're going to have everyone around you do your work for you. Right? You're shirking. So incompetence, a smart, incompetent person will have people around him. That dog, he might be too stupid to bark when a burglar comes, so what he'll do is he'll outsource it to the chihuahua next door. That way, when it turns out that it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex, guess who the Tyrannosaurus Rex eats? Okay, the twitchy little dog. I don't know what that had to do with anything here, but okay. Okay, you might think, well, agency cost is kind of a problem, but it's not my problem. Well, when you get into the world, you are an agent and you will do things that are in your own interest, even in situations where you most definitely shouldn't. Let me give you an example. The parent is the agent, the child is the principal. Imagine yourself in 20 years. You have worked like a dog for 12 hours. You come dragging your butt back into the house and there are all your kids. They're just bouncing up and down on the sofa and the chairs. They're swinging from the chandeliers. Now, what you should do as the agent is grab the children. Come on, sweeties. I'm going to make you a homemade, made-from-scratch meal, and then we're going to read bookies and play games, and then I'll give you baths and tuck you in the bed and tell you stories to make you go to sleep. Oh, of course I will. I love you so much. I'm your agent. You're my principal. No, you know what's going to happen? You're going to drag your butt into that chair, and you're just going to flop down, stare at those kids. You know, stop bouncing on that. You're a bad kid. Here, take my belt. Beat your ass. Stand in the corner. Yeah. You're bad. And so is your mother. You will. Trust me. I don't know if you will or not. But look. Remember I said that the principals were the ones who should monitor and enforce? Those kids can't. They don't know enough to. They're not tough enough to. A doctor, have you ever been in surgery? You haven't, have you? Oh dear. Have you? Okay, you've been in surgery. The doctor is the agent, you are the principal. The doctor is there to maximize your welfare. When you were under anesthesia, could you monitor and enforce the doctor? No, you couldn't. You were out. You were gone. For all you know, he took your colon out and did doo 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 doo. You didn't know. You had no idea.
I had no clue.
Lawyer, supposed to be your agent. You don't know enough about law, and of course, he's already made a sweet deal with the prosecutor to get his rich client off by hanging you for on some phony drug charge. I mean, what was it? You know, you were just trying some of the stuff in Breaking Bad. How are you supposed to know it was illegal? But you're going to go down because he's made an arrangement to get his other client. He'll let the prosecutor get a feather in his cap on you. And he'll convince you that you've got to write this confession. Because that's all he can do for you. You don't know any better. You're not trained in law. You see, there are a stockholder can't watch the books being done. Can't. No, most stockholders have no idea whether those books are cooked or not. They don't have the training. They cannot monitor and enforce. There are many situations. A marriage, going back to the marriage. You see, the marriage is not even a living thing. It can't monitor and enforce your performance in the contract. It can't. It doesn't exist that way. A soldier, I swore an oath to defend the Constitution. The Constitution, there's a story that goes around quite a few times, every now and then, that former President George W. Bush once raged that the Constitution was nothing but a GD piece of paper. And all you should have seen, oh, that's horrible, he'd say. Well, actually, quite unfortunately, he is exactly right. The Constitution lives only through the actions of its agents. On the battlefield, I can hide. You go out there. You're a Marine. You need to die. And I'll stay in the background. Matter of fact, there have been a number of studies in the Vietnam War that said they showed that most soldiers don't even shoot at the enemy. They shoot over the enemy. They try not to kill. And that, of course, is my job, you know. But defending the Constitution. The paper, the Constitution is a piece of paper. It can't defend itself. It can't monitor me. It can't enforce its needs on me. There are these special relationships, these agency relationships, that where the typical principal is responsible for the agent doesn't hold because the principal has some permanent material defect. Mostly it's not a conscious thing. It's not a conscious entity, and therefore it lives only by the actions of the agents. This is a very special kind of relation agency. This special kind of agency is characterized in Black's Law Dictionary as the highest duty implied by law on an agent, if it is this special. And don't, this word that I'm going to show you here in a minute is bandied about. Laws are written about it. There are times when you will hear that there's a fiduciary duty, but there's none. This duty, first of all, highest. There's nothing higher than highest. And if you got two duties that fall in this category, one is not higher than the other. They are both the highest. I'm going to talk about that with you in just a minute here. But the next one is important. Implied. Like I said, states and the federal government write laws all the time about this fiduciary duty. They say, oh, fiduciary duty is here. No, no, no. Fiduciary duty is implied, which means that it is in common law. The law of the tribe. The law of the clans of the Saxons. The law of the elders of the Ethiopians. The law of the wise men of ancient China. The law of the old ones. In the Navajo. It is timeless. It goes back long before we even wrote. We hear the echoes of it in all of the languages of the Indo-European family group. Lex, logos, ligature, law. The bindings of people, the ligaments that hold people together. Implication underneath, echoing through our law. That's why this is so important. And I'll bet my bottom dollar you haven't been taught about fiduciary duty. How powerful it is. Because it is characterized by three pillars. Trust, fidelity, that means faithfulness. And I'm going to leave the third one for you. It's in the PowerPoint that I've posted, just to make sure you go there and find it. Trust, fidelity, and this other one. The highest duty implied by law. Ancient. So, I belong to a very old secretive organization. I won't mention it. But it has, as some of its great members, in an ancient order of knights. And so many of the knights of the Middle Ages turned into scoundrels, working for the coin of whoever would pay them the most to kill someone or some group or take over a town. But there was this ancient knight belief that there was something that belonged in trust, fidelity, and this other one. They were talking about that fiduciary duty in that. They were also talking, somewhere in all of this, we might even be talking about someone who has a duty that goes beyond just, I'm going to make $1 billion today by going for the jugular. I'm not even a citizen of this country, so why should I care? Underneath it all, why should I worry? Because I'm taking $1 billion from people who are going to be in poverty. They're going to commit suicides. They're going to get sick and die or be permanently disabled because they don't have money, because the economy spiraled into a death recession because of what I did. Somewhere in there, you begin to ask this question about that kind of fiduciary duty. But let me go back to another point here. Highest. There are no degrees of highest. So your lives will have fiduciary duty in them. In my life, I ran a corporation. I was on the road. I was in planes. I was around the world. But I also had a family. So I had a fiduciary duty to that corporation's shareholders to maximize our welfare. My highest duty was to them. But I also had a marriage and a kids. My highest duty was to them too. And so I tried to play that I could put them in an order. Company now, family then, family over here for Disney, then the company here. Well, I went home one night after I'd come back on a plane from an awful, grueling trip. And I ran into something really weird. A house that was empty. You see, fiduciary duty won't wait for you. If you do not honor your fiduciary duty, sooner or later, your principals who relied upon you with trust, fidelity, and that other one, they'll move on. And you keep that in mind. When you take on fiduciary duties, make sure that you are not going to try to play ordering of the highest, because the highest is of the highest. That's all I have for you. Go home.